From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we'll be discussing health in Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous nation. Our guest is Sandy Craig, a family practitioner from Vermont who has spent several years working in Indonesia. When he learned of the recent natural disasters impacting the area on December 26th, he arranged a leave from his medical practice to do relief work in Aceh, the province most heavily impacted by the earthquake and tsunami. Today, Dr. Craig will be discussing the health of Indonesia, the impacts of the tsunami, and his relief work there. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. State and local health officials have encountered difficulty in fighting high rates of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases in many southern U.S. states, according to participants of the Southern HIV Prevention Initiative, which held a conference in early May in Atlanta. The number of AIDS cases rose 27% in six southern states, just between the three-year period of 2000 to 2002. This compares with an 11% increase in Midwestern states during the same period and little increased in many of the other northern states. Southeastern states also have the nation's highest rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea, two other sexually transmitted diseases. High rates of poverty and poor health care services were identified as two factors that have led to difficulty controlling these diseases. In addition, in the southern states, a higher proportion of the population has no form of health insurance coverage compared to other regions of the country. Health officials say the diversity of the population and also the isolation of certain groups in the south, such as migrant farm workers, makes it difficult to provide education to affected populations about many health issues. Also, many immigrants are suspicious of government assistance. State governments in the region have experienced significant fiscal distress and, reflecting an increasing trend in public health, much of the funding for the initiative is coming from Pfizer, a drug company that is involved in the production of drugs used in the treatment of HIV disease. A trade dispute has been brewing between Brazil and the United States over the high price of drugs used to treat HIV infection. This has been going on since February of 2001. At that time, the Brazilian government announced that if prices of two anti-AIDS drugs were not reduced by later that year, the government of Brazil would allow their companies to violate patent protection and produce the medicines. Brazil has earned praise for its anti-AIDS campaign, which has included free distribution of anti-HIV drugs to all infected Brazilians free of charge. At least 580,000 Brazilians are HIV positive or have AIDS, but the number of new cases has stabilized and AIDS-related deaths have begun to fall in recent years. Last week, the International Medical Aid Agency, Doctors Without Borders, criticized the Brazilian government for failing to keep its pledge to break antiretroviral drug patents and produce generic versions of these medicines. Once again, in March this year, the Brazilian government again threatened to break the patents on several critical HIV drugs by April 4th if the drug manufacturers did not agree to allow the country to produce generic equivalents or sell them at discounted prices. But despite the failure of the drug companies to yield on the issue, Brazil has failed to carry out its promise to begin domestic production of the drugs. Doctors Without Borders issued a press release characterizing the lack of action on the part of Brazilian authorities as incomprehensible, 107 other aid organizations signed the statement that was developed by Doctors Without Borders. Their website is msf.org. Virtually every state across the country is facing a deficit in the funding for state Medicaid programs. The Kaiser Family Foundation compiles reports on this issue at their website, kaisernetwork.org. The most recent report highlights events in three states which are facing crises in the costs of their Medicaid programs. The State Senate of New Hampshire has been grappling with a decline in employer-sponsored health insurance that has come at the same time as an increase in Medicaid enrollment. The New Hampshire Senate's Majority Leader, Robert Clegg, is exploring proposals to stiffen eligibility requirements to qualify for Medicaid and to subsidize insurance premiums for small businesses. New Hampshire is also considering a proposal that would require employers with 10,000 or more workers to spend a minimum of 8% of their payroll on employee health benefits or pay the difference to help the state provide coverage under Medicaid. In New Jersey, the State Assembly is set to vote on a proposal that will require employers with more than 10,000 workers to increase the level of their health care coverage or pay an extra $2.45 per employee into the state's Medicaid program. If the measure passes, the employer that would face the largest assessment would be Walmart, which employs 12,000 people in New Jersey. Finally, in Pennsylvania, the legislature is considering a bill that would require companies with 20 or more employees to publish annual reports saying how many of their workers are receiving health insurance through the state Medicaid program. The bill is viewed as being the first step toward mandating that large companies assume a larger proportion of health costs, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. During just the three-year period from 2000 to 2003, the number of uninsured young adults between 19 and 29 years of age increased by over 2 million, according to the Commonwealth Fund. Over 30% of young adults in the U.S. have no form of health insurance, a higher percentage than any other age group. The study authors point out that while this group generates lower health costs than other age groups, it is nonetheless an important age to facilitate access to medical care, since important conditions can be detected and treated, ranging from high blood pressure to abnormal pap smears. For these and many other health conditions, early detection and treatment can prevent disability and even death if detected before irreversible changes have developed. The report is available at the Commonwealth Fund's website, cmwf.org. Coming up next, a report from the trenches of the tsunami. A Vermont doctor describes his experiences assisting with the medical care crisis Indonesia faced in the wake of the tsunami. So stay with us. Despite having the fourth largest population in the world and abundant natural resources, the island nation of Indonesia is largely neglected by the media in the U.S. The preponderance of Indonesia's population is poor and has great unmet health needs. Aceh was one of the poorer provinces of Indonesia even before December 26th last year. But the double hit of a powerful earthquake, followed immediately by a tidal wave, devastated the already poor region. On today's show, our guest is Sandy Craig, just back from his work at a mobile clinic in Aceh. Dr. Craig is a family practitioner who took a temporary leave from his medical practice in a rural clinic from Plainfield, Vermont, to work as a medical doctor in the part of Aceh that lay right in the path of the natural disasters. Doubly trained in family practice and emergency medicine, and fluent in the Indonesian language, Dr. Craig was in a unique position to directly assist the people in Aceh with their effort to recover from the natural disasters. On today's show, we'll be discussing the health of Indonesia, the impacts of the recent natural disasters, and the medical relief work he was involved in on his recent trip to Indonesia. Sandy Craig, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks, Marvin. Good to be here.
Before we discuss the work you undertook on your recent trip to Aceh that was so impacted by the recent tsunami, it might be useful to give the listeners some background about Indonesia and Aceh. I know that Indonesia is one of the most densely populated countries in the world, but despite that, you hardly ever hear about Indonesia in the media.
Well, it's true, Marvin. It's a little bit of a paradox to me. Indonesia is the fourth most populous nation in the world, yet for some reason this country tends to be very naive about its particulars and its potential. It's the largest OPEC nation in the world. It's the largest, most populous Muslim country in the world. 90% of population of Indonesia are Muslim. And it certainly ought to be a major player in the world theater. Aceh is the northernmost province of the island of Sumatra. Sumatra is a huge island, really more like a subcontinent.
And the whole country is a bunch of islands, a group of islands, right?
Right. Indonesia itself is composed of approximately 13,000 habitable islands and comprises about 1,200 language groups, all of them more or less of Indo-Malay root, but all of those languages are mutually unintelligible to each other. So it's a remarkable challenge to keep a nation like that together. But most everybody speaks the lingua franca, Bahasa Indonesia, there, which is everybody's second language.
You mentioned that the people of Indonesia speak many languages. Is there a sense of a country there, or is it fairly divided? Do people have more loyalty to their area or their island or their linguistic group or their culture?
Well, Indonesia is the sort of place where you can drive 50 miles and you're in a different language group, a different culture, with different dress, different common customs, different foods, different ways of fixing their hair. It's tremendously diverse in a way that Americans can't really even grasp. We're so homogenized here. But in the early days after independence in 1949, Sukarno, the first president of Indonesia, did a really remarkable job as a statesman of giving Indonesia an identity as a nation. So many Indonesians do really have a sense of nationhood and identity and patriotism. That having been said, all these different ethnic and language groups are often quite ethnocentric and have a great deal of their own sort of nationalistic pride. Aceh is right up there in terms of their own sense of national pride. They have always seen themselves as fairly distinct from the rest of the archipelago. They were the only province never to be conquered by the Dutch colonialists and have really continued their struggle against what they regarded as foreign domination, even after Indonesia became an independent nation and sought to unite all those cultures under one flag. And their resistance movement has really heated up again in the last 20 years, and there's been quite a nasty little war going on in the province of Aceh.
So it's a movement for independence, is that the
idea? Yeah, the independence movement is called GAM, or the Gerakan Aceh Merdeka, which means the Movement for Acehese Freedom. And most of their leaders are living outside the country in Europe, especially Scandinavia. But the movement still has a great deal of indigenous support.
One thing we haven't yet discussed is the level of affluence of the people of Indonesia. Overall, among all the islands that make up the country, is it overall fairly poor, and is the level of affluence evenly distributed, or are there some islands or parts of the country that are wealthier than others?
Well, the country is spectacularly wealthy, but that wealth is held by less than 1% of the population. It's an incredibly diverse country, as I mentioned before, but you're right. As you get away from the more densely populated areas and into the outer islands, obviously the trickle-down effect of the wealth of the archipelago gets a little less the further you get away from Jakarta and away from the central island of Java, where the government resides. And you have areas that are still lagging quite far behind the rest of the region in terms of development, and including some of Aceh, and that therein lies a lot of the resentment that fuels the resistance movement. Aceh itself is a very wealthy province in terms of natural resources, especially natural gas and oil, as well as agricultural productivity. And they feel that the degree of money coming back to them has not been concomitant with the amount of wealth that the government has been extracting from Aceh. So there's a great deal of resentment there. A great deal of Aceh remains quite poor.
Well, finally, let's try to get a context of health in Indonesia. Maybe we could talk about some basic public health parameters that we often look at. For example, can most pregnant women expect their babies to survive through childhood? Do most people live to become senior citizens, or is there a lot of premature death? Do you know if data are available on basic diseases like, say, cancer or malaria or the like?
Well, this is exactly the frustrating part about doing healthcare in Indonesia, Marvin, and in a lot of the world, because public health data is really a luxury of the developed world. In Indonesia, they have their hands full trying to provide even the most basic services and trying to stamp out the latest cholera and polio epidemics. In 1995, my wife traveled over there from Duke University to do her PhD research in medical anthropology with traditional healers, and we were traveling to Indonesia to do that research, and I was looking for work to do as a doc and spent some time in Jakarta talking with a lot of the healthcare officials. And in one discussion with the deputy minister of public health, who is a wonderful guy named Ibrahim, I was dying to ask him what the number one cause of death in Indonesia was. In the United States, of course, is coronary artery disease, and I was imagining it would be the same over there.
Why would you have thought that?
Well, especially because cooking over there is delicious, but everybody fries their three meals a day in coconut oil, which is one of the most atherogenic substances known, and many people smoke those clove cigarettes, and everybody eats plenty of salt, and hypertension is not treated, if it's even looked for at all. And so with all those risk factors abounding in the society, you'd imagine that there would be a great deal of coronary artery disease. And he'd said, "You'd think so, wouldn't you?" And I said, "Well, do you know?" And he said, "No, we don't keep any data on that, and that's because we have our hands full with this other thing." These other things, and
with treating basic diseases, or is that what you mean?
And trying desperately to provide even the most basic services, and in some of the outer islands, the situations medically were quite desperate. Hospitals were ferrocement shells with really very little inside them, no services or apparatus or labs or X-rays, and no staff. They were essentially places where people came out of hope and usually ended up dying. Hospitals were known as places where you went to die and not necessarily to get help. And, of course, they have a terrible problem with brain drain from the outer islands. As soon as somebody gets enough training, they want to go and make a decent wage, which is not to be had. So they'll either go to Java or leave the country.
So Java, sounds like, from what you're saying, Java is the wealthy island?
For the most part, yeah. That's where the seat of government is.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about the health system there. Are there dentists or doctors available for most people, or how does that break down?
Well, it depends on who you are and where you live. In Jakarta, you can have pretty much anything that you want. I mean, and that goes as a general statement and also as a particular statement about healthcare. If you happen to come from a underserved outer island region, there's a real dearth of the healthcare opportunity available to you. Where I got posted when I went to do relief work in Aceh was on the west coast of the province, the coast that was facing and was closest to the epicenter of the earthquake. All of the infrastructure of that region goes along the coast. There's a very flat, fertile region that runs between the ocean and the hills, and that's where all the major population centers, a whole string of small cities connected by the coastal road, which is the only main road in the area, as well as all the power stations, the electric lines, the hospitals, and most of the population. That all got absolutely wiped out by the tsunami, leaving communities inland in the hills completely without any kind of resources. Their economy came to a standstill. All of their power was cut off. Whenever they got sick, if they had enough money, they could go down to the coastal towns where there were doctors and hospitals and possibly get treated. But if they didn't have the resources to do that, they didn't have the transportation, they didn't have the money for the transportation, they didn't have money to pay for the medical care, they didn't have that medical care. And there was very little going on in the interior in terms of government provision of basic health needs. There were some programs that tried to train the local village midwives to improve techniques there. There were some moves towards community clinics that were staffed by people that had minimal training and a very limited supply of medicines. But for the most part, routine infections and ailments such as hypertension were not even dealt with. And this is the region that we came to set up our organization of mobile clinics and hospitals to serve this population and the population of IDPs, as they say in the relief business, internally displaced people.
One more observation about the population. Did it seem like there were many people who lived to be elderly? Did it seem like there was a reasonably normal percentage of elderly people, or did it seem like most people don't survive?
No, there were not very many elderly people there. And even more sort of sobering was that the elderly people that were around were my age. And that was a very striking thing for me. I'm 46, and I'm in reasonably good shape, I think. And over there, you're elderly by the time you're pushing 50, and you look it. And I was trying to get a handle on what that was about. It looked like a sort of an accelerated senescence there, and I wasn't able to get a sense of whether that was because of the environment, whether it was because of lack of health care, or just what exactly was going on. A long history and lifetime of health care problems that weren't dealt with, recurrent malaria, exposure to a number of tropical diseases throughout your life. Don't know. And that's the sort of thing that just isn't going to get known, because it's not many people out there studying that sort of thing, and there's nobody keeping data about it.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik, and our guest today is Sandy Craig. We've been discussing Indonesia and the health of its people. After the break, we'll be discussing the impact of the tsunami on the people of Aceh and the work Dr. Craig was involved in. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest today is Sandy Craig, a family practitioner from Plainfield, Vermont, who recently returned from Aceh, the island of Indonesia that was most impacted by the powerful earthquake of December 26th and the devastating tsunami that promptly followed. Now back to the interview. Dr. Craig, since we sometimes work together, I know up close how difficult it was for you to drop your medical practice here in Vermont, to travel far away and participate in that aid effort in Indonesia. So I'd like to talk a bit about what motivated you to travel to Indonesia to help with that recovery effort. And I know that one thing that affected your decision was the fact that you're fluent in the language spoken there in Aceh. So maybe you could start out by briefly telling us about your previous experience in Indonesia and how you became fluent and then why you returned.
Well, after I graduated from the University of California and got my undergraduate degree, I headed off to Indonesia for a variety of reasons. That was the place that I wanted to go for some of the reasons that we've been talking about. It's a very, very exciting place culturally. A very exciting place biologically, but also I had a sense back there in the late 70s when I was graduating from school that as the largest Islamic country in the world, I wanted to get a handle on this new force that I was recognizing in the world order of things. And I also had a sense that our culture needed to come to terms with this, and I wanted that to happen through communication. And I thought that English language would be a useful item for students in Indonesia. So that's what I went over there to do, was to teach English at that point at an Islamic university in the provincial capital of Bandung. I went over there with sort of a minimum of Indonesian language training and picked up Indonesian really on the fly. I spent over 2 years on Java, and they were some of the best years of my life, and I formed some of the deepest friendships I've ever had there. And then went back there later on with my wife when she did her PhD research. And altogether, I've lived probably a total of 4 years in that archipelago. And it's just a wonderful, rich life over there, and very, very dramatic. So those years really sunk into me. And when, as a country doc in Vermont, I heard about this disaster over there, and the call went out for doctors with primary care experience, which I have, and emergency medicine experience, which I have, and an interest in infectious disease, which I have, which is really sort of a survival skill if you live in the tropics, is an understanding of infectious disease, and Indonesian language skills. This was something that I really just couldn't sit out. I really felt a very strong compulsion to go over there and do what I could, and as it turned out, my language especially was particularly useful.
But you also come from a family with a heritage that is interested in the rest of the world. Is that not true?
That's right. My father was the first director of training for the Peace Corps way back in the early 60s under Sergeant Shriver in the Kennedy administration. I grew up playing around on exercise equipment at these Peace Corps training grounds, and so my whole family's orientation has been sort of international and public service oriented.
And you've worked elsewhere in the developing world besides Indonesia, right?
Yeah, I've done some work in Africa as well and in Latin America. But my heart is really strongly with my days in Indonesia. And like I said, when the call went out for people that knew the language over there, I just really didn't have much personal alternative. Really could not have lived with myself had I not gone.
So you worked in the Aceh province on the island of Sumatra, really the ground zero point of the earthquake and tsunami, right?
The island of Sumatra was the one most affected by the tsunami, and the northernmost province of Sumatra, Aceh, was the most badly hit by the wave. Just to give you some figures of the magnitude of this event, Aceh province had a population of approximately 500,000 before the wave. And on the day that I arrived in Jakarta on my way to do relief work there, on the one-month anniversary of the wave, the Indonesian government moved all those people that were on the missing list onto the dead list, and the dead list reached 240,000 at that point. That was the Indonesian government's official estimate of the death toll from the tsunami. The capital of Aceh is Banda Aceh, a city of almost 250,000. About a third of the city got utterly wiped out, along with losing about a third of the population. And another third of the city got badly damaged by high waters and flood damage. So this really was a catastrophe of epic proportion there.
So you arrived in Aceh in early February, is that right?
End of January.
The end of January. So that was about a month after the earthquake and tsunami had occurred. And had you seen much evidence of a recovery effort after that month had passed?
Absolutely. There was some physical recovery. I don't know how much emotional recovery there had been at that point. The streets of Banda Aceh, the capital city of the province, had been, for the most part, cleared of the debris. There were sort of different levels of destruction there. There were the areas that were absolutely vaporized by the force of this incredibly powerful wave that worked like a hydrogen bomb in some areas of the city. And then where the wave had sort of played out its force, it still brought very, very high tides and floodwaters that damaged a great deal of the rest of the city and floated, you know, huge drifts of debris and freighters and fishing boats into the middle of the city. And there were big banks of junk and cars and buses and trees that had gotten uprooted by the force of the wave. And a lot of that had been cleared away and pushed to the side so that you could navigate through the city. But the streets were still quite deserted. The whole society was still very much in a low crouch. People hadn't come out. The markets really hadn't opened. And I was in Banda Aceh for a week before I got transferred out into the outlying areas to help set up the system of mobile clinics. And I was out there in the villages for a month. And on my return to Banda Aceh, it was a completely different city. People had emerged from their shell. The markets were open. People were out on the streets, and the roads were full of cars and motorcycles and bicycles, and it had come alive again. It was vibrant again, even though there was still a great deal of destruction all around. So there was a strong physical component, obviously, of the destruction, but also a very strong cultural and psychological component.
What we might call post-traumatic stress disorder, is that the idea?
Oh, boy, that is going to be probably the major issue in this region. They needed a lot of things early on, from doctors to heavy equipment moving debris, but what they are probably going to need in the future is a freighter full of trauma psychiatrists and maybe another freighter full of Prozac.
You mentioned earlier that most of the health infrastructure on the island of Aceh was near the coast and was wiped out. I would assume that would include the major hospitals. Was there a big hit on the workforce as well?
80% of the health workers in the province of Aceh died in the tsunami. Most of the doctors in Banda Aceh were killed. Of course, most of the support staff, technical staff, nurses, technicians were killed as well. Of all of the medical staff at the major university hospital, one returned to work in that first month after the tsunami.
So when you went there to aid with the medical aspects of the recovery effort, that they made a decision to have you up in the more rural area and not to work in the previous population centers? Was that? And so tell me about your work and where you were.
Well, the previous population centers were gone. As I said, on that west coast, the string of coastal towns, which were the major population centers and contained all the resources, were gone. there were a fair number of survivors, in fact, a great deal of refugees that are referred to as IDPs, internally displaced people, that made their way into the interior and were sort of absorbed by the communities there. There are many camps that were provided by various non-government organizations, like the UN, that were tent cities. Many of the schools and mosques were turned into IDP camps. And a lot of the people got sort of absorbed into the communities by family connections, and houses that contained five people before now contained 10 or 15. Of course, this meant that the sanitation and water sources on the interior got a whole new level of use and strain on them, creating perfect conditions for outbreaks of, you know, our old enemies like cholera and typhoid, malaria, measles. So our task was multifold. One was that we had to provide basic health care for a population that suddenly didn't have a health care system to rely on anymore. We also had a population of people that had absolutely nothing, the refugee population or IDP population, that needed support. We also had this ticking time bomb that was ripe for various infectious disease outbreaks, so we were sort of the sentinels out there to identify where these things popped up and hopefully stamp them out, or at least keep data on them so that we could alert the various organizations that specialized in throwing cordons around outbreaks like this. And we actually did have an outbreak of measles in one of the IDP camps, and UNICEF and some of the other NGOs that do public health did spectacular jobs of containing these outbreaks that occurred. And one of the things that International Medical Corps, who I worked with, helped with was vaccination programs.
So you worked in a mobile clinic, was that the idea?
We set up a base clinic in a fairly large population center in the interior and used that as a base to run mobile clinics out to 10 or 15 villages that were in the immediate area.
Since you arrived in Aceh about a month after the earthquake and tsunami, I would assume that most of the immediate victims of major trauma, especially crush injuries from the earthquake, would either have died already or already been treated. So tell me about what kinds of health problems you actually were treating in the population there.
Well, that's exactly right. Your first idea is true. The doctors who were there on the scene quite early on were telling me that they were surprised to find that immediately after the wave hit, there was very little trauma. If this thing got a hold of you, you were killed. And so there really wasn't a whole lot of trauma as a direct result of the tsunami and the earthquake that came in. As a result, however, of the tsunami, there was, of course, the water supplies everywhere were tainted. And whatever sewage treatment facilities were around were completely either washed away or overwhelmed. And so there was the sanitation situation was quite dangerous there, and the water for drinking and cooking was a very big problem, even in the city of Banda Aceh. So we were seeing a lot of diarrheal illnesses, something that we never see in this country, tetanus. Of course, the tsunami left whole plains of debris, and of course people went out there picking through the debris looking for anything to salvage, and there's plenty of disrupted lumber out there with nails sticking out of them, so they're stepping on nails out there, and what do you know? There were many, many cases of tetanus. Another reminder of why we immunize. Tetanus is just something that we don't see in this country, and we are seeing dozens of cases of it over there. And routinely over there, they have malaria, and some of it is highly resistant falciparum malaria, which is a very dangerous disease. We are seeing plenty of that. We are seeing typhoid and possibly some cholera. All the sort of common and usual things that people get, upper respiratory infections, pneumonias,
One of the things that we saw a great deal of was wound infections there, with the sanitation being what it was and the lack of medical facilities. Even minor wounds in the tropical climate quickly became involved in these really god-awful infections. And we were dealing with those quite frequently.
For those just joining us, my guest today is Sandy Craig, a medical doctor from Vermont who has spent several years in Indonesia. Dr. Craig recently returned from a month on the island of Sumatra, and in today's interview, he's describing the medical relief work he was doing in the Aceh province of western Sumatra, the region of the island most heavily impacted by the recent earthquake and tidal wave. Now back to the interview. You mentioned treating diseases like cholera and malaria, but of course people don't go to the doctor saying, I think I have cholera, would you mind treating me? They instead go to the doctor because they have diarrhea or they have a fever or feel sick. So what I'm getting at is that you would need some degree of lab or maybe x-ray testing to diagnose some of these conditions, and I'm wondering if that was available for you.
Well, it's true and it's not true. We can make pretty educated guesses about some of the patterns of symptoms that you get with certain kinds of diseases, like typhoid, can stick out as being different from other febrile illnesses, and cholera has a very distinct way of presenting itself. Malaria is often a little bit tricky in the early stages, but when people get in the end stages of malaria, malaria is one of the most god-awful things you'll ever see. People get very, very sick, and in the morning when walking to the clinic, we'd be able to spot the people, you know, when we were still 100 yards away who had malaria. They were the ones who were lying on the ground having rigors with sweat pouring off of them. So you get a sense of these things. You can walk into a room and know that you're in the same room with TB, with somebody with TB. And
are you saying that some diseases that we might do testing for here in the U.S., you would just presumptively treat because it's pretty clear, it would be clear enough to what people...
It would be clear enough, and there weren't any alternatives. We didn't have any lab support at all. Some of the other aid organizations were making some attempts to do some testing and document what was going on, and we were trying to contribute to that as much as we could. But for the most part, we had to shoot at what we thought was there and rely on our clinical judgment. And of course, like you were saying, so we saw a lot of people coming in with just a routine cough and probably had a common cold. We had to be able to reassure people, this is a cold, this is not a cold. This cough is caused by you're smoking too many clove cigarettes, and this cough is caused by the fact that you have a parasitic infection that you need to take this medicine for. And we had to make as good a guess as we could. But the very frustrating thing was that a lot of times we just were utterly clueless about what we were dealing with, especially since, you know, this is a place where we don't practice. I mean, the tropics is very, very different from rural Vermont, so there's a certain amount of experience that you really have to be able to be effective over there. And we just, foreign docs that didn't grow up practicing over there, just didn't have it. We had to try to compensate by reading as much as we could while we were there and relying on what we could figure out on our own.
Did you have the opposite experience where you might identify a disease and be fairly confident about what was wrong but didn't have medicine to treat it that you might have had if the whole situation had occurred here in the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. And that was probably one of the most painful aspects of this, was seeing things that are easily treatable in this country and having absolutely no resources to deal with them. We saw, for instance, people with sky-high blood pressures, and all we could do was tell them to lay off the salt. We had no medicines to treat that. And even fresh heart attacks that would walk in through the door, we could do nothing for them other than give them an aspirin and just watch them. And if they survived the day, give them a lift back to their house that night, hope they survived the night. People that developed acute abdominal catastrophes like an appendicitis, we really didn't have much to offer them, especially after the aid organization started cutting back on helicopter evacuations. In the early days, we were able to evacuate some of our sicker people that needed needed surgery, but we had no surgical facilities there other than very, very basic stuff. Even the people that we were able to evacuate by helicopter, we had to triage them very carefully and decide who was most liable to benefit from the rare services that we could possibly scrounge up and offer them. And that was a very, very difficult choice to make sometimes.
Why did your ability to transport people out by helicopter get worse during the time you were there?
I don't know the economics of this. In the early days, there was a lot of helicopter traffic in the first 2 months after the tsunami. But as time went on, that space became more and more precious, to the extent that by the time I left, they were only transporting aid workers in and out and only on very, very essential business and medical evacuations at all, but stopped.
You're indicating that it was very frustrating to you when you identified illnesses you couldn't treat that would have been easily handled here in the U.S. But how did the patients you were treating react to that? Did you end up explaining that, or did it just not come up?
No, I couldn't talk about that with them. They, of course, handled their illnesses generally with great stoicism and a great deal of courage and poise. We had to watch a lot of people die over there. For the most part, people were very happy to have us there and generally were pretty attentive to how we advised them to use what medicines we did have. And I think we did a lot of good that way. But there was also the frustration that, you know, it's just not a very sophisticated population sometimes that we were working with, and they would feel better that 2 days after they had started their malaria medicine and then just stop it, not finish the course, and their malaria would come roaring back and they'd be sick again. And this is not an unheard of situation even in this country in my own patient population.
Clearly a population that is poor and not exposed to a Western education will have very different conceptions about health. And I wondered if there were ideas about health that actually affected your practice that were prevalent there.
Well, there were many, many of those. They had very interesting notions about what Western medicine was and what they thought it was and what it ought to be. We would often give people one medicine, they'd say, well, the last time I came to a doctor and got sick, I got the purple pills or I got the pink pills. You know, what are you giving me these blue ones for? And part of that was the cultural gap, but also these people attribute disease a lot of times to very, very different processes than we do. And in Western Aceh, there's a great deal of belief in spirits and spirit possession as a cause of disease. And these ideas are actually pretty accepted among well-educated and fairly sophisticated people. We had two particularly courageous and gifted medical students that worked with us at our post.
Your medical students were from Indonesia itself?
They were both Achenese and had been in their final school year. They'd been in their final year of medical school in the medical school at Banda Aceh, which was now destroyed. And the IMC, International Medical Corps, had snapped them up. They were fluent in English and well-educated in the local healthcare systems and local diseases. So they were an invaluable resource to us, even though they hadn't completed their medical education. They were fantastic in terms of providing us with translation services and a window into the culture and communities. Iqbal was a devilishly handsome and very bright young man. He was also a very good jazz guitarist. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to bring his jazz guitar on the helicopter with him to come down to our post. But he had remarkable poise and self-possession in the face of the horrible events that he had witnessed and participated in. He'd worked in the hospital in the early days, right after the tsunami, taking care of people that had poured into the hospitals, and then later volunteered for duty picking up bodies, of which there were just an incalculable number. He was a very sensitive man, but bore this with unusual insight and strength. And he also happened to have a great deal of knowledge about the people's beliefs in the spirit world and how to mediate some of the conceptual problems that people had with their experiences of being possessed by spirits. He was very useful in that respect. And I asked his colleague, the other medical student, Delta, who was a close friend of his. I said, you know, Delta, Iqbal is very, he's very mature for his age, it seems. And Delta nodded and said, well, actually, he has the spirit of his grandfather living in there with him. And his grandfather helps him to be strong and advises him because his grandfather was a great spirit healer. So Iqbal has a great deal of knowledge about spirit possession and matters of spirits. And I said, okay, that explains a lot. And it did for Delta. Delta's a very well-educated, sophisticated man, and he accepted this absolutely in his close friend. And to a degree, I had to also. I had to admit that Iqbal was a very unusual guy and seemed to have a wisdom and a self-possession beyond his years.
Now, I guess I'd like to ask one more question about the work you were trying to do up there in the rural areas in Aceh. You mentioned earlier that there's a military conflict going on in Aceh, as also a military conflict in other parts of Indonesia. Did the military conflict affect the relief work you were doing there in Aceh?
It did complicate things tremendously, Marvin. The situation was very complex in Aceh. It was a disaster area in a conflict zone. So it was sort of a double whammy of hardship for the population and a very ticklish political and social situation, as well as being a god-awful physical predicament. The place where we got posted was literally on contested turf between the Indonesian military and the resistance movement. And the Indonesian military was very frustrated by the chaos that the natural disaster had caused, and had caused them to feel very out of control of the social situation, which they had been trying to get in hand for the last 10 or 15 years. The military had set up posts in our areas and were very concerned about us traveling into contested areas, ostensibly for our own safety. GOM, on the other hand, the resistance movement, of course, were very welcoming to us and were completely unthreatening. And we had no trouble working in their areas, except to the degree that the Indonesian military did not want us going into those areas. And that brought us into conflict with the Indonesian military.
So you're saying that the government's own military was more of a threat to you than the rebel army?
Well, it's hard to assess exactly how much of a threat there really was. The Indonesian military was telling us that they couldn't guarantee our safety from GOM, and we told them politely that we understood that, and that our assignment was to go find sick people and render aid to them. There were many of those in those contested areas, and they would tell us very pointedly that they did not want us getting caught in crossfires, and we would tell them, well, you have our schedule, you know what towns we're going to be in, what days. Perhaps that might influence where you decide to do your next, you know, operation. But they kept the pressure on nonetheless, and it was always ostensibly in that very polite yet insistent manner of pushing their case that they could not guarantee our safety, even after we had the assurances of the GOM command that we were under no threat from them.
So were you exposed to gunfire?
We heard gunfire in our village several times. Most of the time it was so far away that the local people didn't even pay any attention to it. There were a couple of times that the gunfire was close enough that people ran for cover. And there were firefights in the area where there were casualties. And the Indonesian military used these as examples of why we shouldn't go to these areas. A couple of the areas were areas where I had established clinics and had already set up relationships with the local people, and it made it very, very difficult to keep my promises of going back there and rendering a routine clinic on a schedule when there are military operations going on there that were getting people shot. It did introduce a real degree of complexity into the whole situation.
You mentioned earlier that you took a leave from your medical practice, and I assume you made that decision during the first few weeks after the tsunami. And then you made an announcement that you were going to be leaving your medical practice there in Plainfield, Vermont. And you told me a few weeks ago when we first discussed this that you were quite surprised at the response of your patients and in the community. And I was wondering if you could tell us about that. What happened?
Well, I was. That was one of the most profound experiences I had in this whole event. And that occurred even before I left. And that was that the decision that I made to go over to Indonesia was an intensely personal one based on my own, who I was, and based on my own history with Indonesia, which goes back a long, long time. As I mentioned, there was just, you know, no way I would have been able to live with myself had I not been able to go back there and do something. And that was pretty clear to me. But when I announced that I was going to be leaving for a while to do this, there was this amazing outpouring of sentiment from the community, especially my clinic. They were overwhelmingly supportive of this, which, of course, my absence put them all at increased on increased duty and working harder. But my patients and the community in general showed this amazing outpouring of sentiment about this. I was getting letters from people, from church groups and from schoolrooms, and envelopes full of pictures drawn by school children about where I was going, and people coming and asking me if they could go with me. Patients saying, you know, I'm a heavy equipment operator. Take me with you. I can be of use over there. It's true, they would have been, but it just struck me that here in rural Vermont, there was this amazing compassion for people clear on the other side of the planet. And it was very heartfelt and very, very genuine. And here I was, I had this, my own special connection that made it unavoidable for me to the question of going. But these folks seem to be absolutely equal in sentiment.
Well, Sandy Craig, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
It's been a pleasure, Marvin.
Anyone wishing to speak with Dr. Craig directly will be able to contact him through the Public Health Radio website, publichealthradio.org. And those wishing to learn more about the work of International Medical Corps, the medical aid organization which organized the work Dr. Craig did in Indonesia, can check out their website, imcworldwide.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.